TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Routine releases from nuclear reactors. The largest single line item in the energy bill passed in late 2005 is the authorization of $4.3 billion for nuclear power. The proponents of nuclear power now claim that nuclear power plants need to be brought back in order to prevent global warming. The Nuclear Information Resource Service responded to that claim by stating, "Nuclear power is not emission-free. From uranium mining, milling, and enrichment to construction and waste storage, nuclear uses fossil fuels. Nuclear power plants are also cost prohibitive. One reactor takes 7 to 10 years to build. Reactors cost $4 billion or more each a decade ago, and the price hasn't gone down. Devoting scarce resources to shore up nuclear takes away from the real climate change solutions, conservation, energy efficiency, and renewables like wind and solar." The anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, organized a conference in late 2005 to bring together the latest information on nuclear power. Two sessions were dedicated to routine releases and nuclear reactor emergencies. Kay Dry is a board member of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Since 1974, she has worked on hazards from so-called routine releases of radioactive gases and waste from nuclear power plants. In 1976, she chaired a statewide campaign in Missouri that resulted in the cancellation of a nuclear reactor already under construction. Here is Kay Dry.
In the 30 years since my first public speech on nuclear power, that is, against nuclear power, I've asked many questions, read many documents, and have consulted with many experts in the field. The result has been an even greater bias against nuclear power. My favorite reason for disliking nuclear power is that workers are exposed to radiation at facilities throughout the uranium fuel cycle, from mining through the handling of the waste. My second favorite reason is what brings me here today. The fact that every nuclear facility releases radioactive waste to the environment as a part of its routine operation. It does not take an accident. I remember when I first learned about routine releases. I was walking toward a public meeting at the Callaway nuclear plant, under construction at the time in Missouri, alongside a farmer from Kansas who was fighting the proposed Wolf Creek plant near his farm. He told me there would be a vent in the reactor building, and that radioactive gases would be released to the atmosphere through the vent. I had known that the walls, roof, and foundation of the reactor building were to be built of thick concrete, reinforced with steel bars, and assumed that they were designed to completely seal the radioactivity inside. However, I found out the farmer was right. The reactor building does have a vent. I had often read that a core meltdown plus a break in the containment building would let radioactive gas into the atmosphere. What I had not known is that the building comes with a break in it. That is, a vent for the release of gases, including radioactive gases. In fact, nuclear power plants cannot operate without regular, deliberate releases of radioactive water and gases. The releases from the reactor building are needed to control the pressure, temperature, and humidity, and to keep radioactivity from exceeding government limits for workers. The vents have filters that stop some of the radioactive gases from being released. However, no filtering technology exists for some gases, like xenon-135, which decays into cesium-135, an isotope with a 2-million-year half-life. Certain gaseous and liquid wastes leak or are intentionally removed from the reactor vessel or the steam generators or the irradiated fuel pool during a plant's routine operation. When these waste products are present in concentrations below the alarm set point of the radioactive waste system, the waste can be released to the river or other cooling water source without detection, and therefore without reporting. So no one really knows how much is released. Noble gases, tritium, and other fission and activation products can be released to the atmosphere. Tritiated water, dissolved or entrained noble gases, and other wastes can also be released to the river. I remember being amused when I learned that certain fission gases, like xenon and krypton, are called noble gases because they don't mingle with or form compounds with the hoi polloi. Therefore, while radioactive gas is accidentally or intentionally released to the atmosphere from a plant building, are routed through high-efficiency particulate absolute or HEPA filters before being discharged to the ventilation stacks, noble gases can just pass right through the filters. Tritium, or radioactive hydrogen, can too. A vent is located not only in the domed roof of the reactor containment building, but also in the auxiliary building, the radioactive waste building, and the turbine building. The plant's routine operation includes two types of planned gaseous releases, both venting and purging. To vent a building, a valve is merely opened. To purge a building, a fan is used. In addition to the typical containment building unit vent that may be operated an average of 2 to 4 times a year, newer nuclear power plants have small diameter purge lines, about 8 inches in diameter or less, that can provide a continuous purge while the reactor is at power. Speaking of new power plants, by the way, the last order for a nuclear power plant in the United States that was not subsequently canceled was placed in October 1973, 32 years ago. To return to chemically inert noble gases, while it is correct that noble gases may not readily interact chemically with other materials, they can physically interact. If inhaled or swallowed, noble gases can cause physical harm while passing through the body, or if entrapped within it. They give off physical energy as radiation in the form of particles and rays. The radiation is able to penetrate body tissues. The physical energy of the radioactive particle can change the structure of DNA, just as when a car that is standing still is hit by a car in motion. If the particle mutates a gene that produces an enzyme that is not particularly vital to the cell's machinery, the damage may not even be noticeable. On the other hand, if it mutates a gene important to cell function, very serious manifestations can occur, particularly cancer and other life-shortening diseases, including circulatory, respiratory, muscular, reproductive, and immune system disorders. In addition to the many shorter-lived radioactive gases generated at nuclear power plants, one that is a particular environmental concern and that is produced in high yield in nuclear power reactors and weapons is krypton-85. It has a radioactive half-life of 10.77 years. The krypton-85 that is generated in a reactor today will continue releasing beta particles for at least 10 half-lives or more than 100 years. Back in July 1976, in a paper published in the journal Science, Dr. William Beck, currently a faculty researcher in physics at Niagara University, postulated that the release of great quantities of krypton-85 from reactor fuel reprocessing plants could change the atmospheric ionization background and could, in fact, contaminate the entire atmosphere of the planet Earth. He explained that very little information has been published linking krypton-85 to atmospheric phenomena, probably because only a, quote, small number of scientists are interested in atmospheric electricity, end quote. He said that topics that require further investigation include the net effects of external influences on thunderstorm electrification, the electrically enhanced coalescence of cloud droplets to form raindrops, especially cloudbursts and others. Without a significant increase in research effort, he said, it is likely that krypton-85 will accumulate in the atmosphere faster than our knowledge of related phenomena accumulates, end quote. As with the plant's gases, not all radioactive isotopes can be filtered from the water. No economically feasible technology exists to do so. Tritium, or radioactive hydrogen, for example, cannot be filtered. A great deal of tritium accumulates in a nuclear reactor, both as a fission product that leaks out from the fuel and by the absorption of neutrons by the boron additive in the cooling water. Just as water containing ordinary hydrogen and oxygen is a component of all living cells, tritiated water, a major byproduct of nuclear power plant operation, can also be incorporated into all the cells of the body. Many laboratory studies have shown that long-term chronic exposure to even low concentrations of tritium is more damaging than previously believed. Some of the hazards resulting from tritium uptake include mutations, tumors, and cell death. When I first learned that a great deal of tritium would be released from the nuclear plant being proposed for Missouri at the time, I asked an Oak Ridge health physicist to tell me about tritium. He responded that, quotes, "Tritium is no big deal. All it can do is destroy a DNA molecule." Scientists have been discovering increased evidence of the health hazards of tritium, and they have learned that tritium does not just wash out of the body in several months as previously thought. Instead, residual tritium can become bound to protein, carbohydrate, and fat molecules throughout the body and can continue emitting radiation for between 10 and 17 years. Please remember that tritium, with a half-life of 12 years, cannot be filtered from the air or water releases, and therefore it is not required to be filtered. Other radioactive isotopes are also released to the environment without being filtered when they are at a concentration below the level the plant monitors are set to detect, a level the government has decreed to be acceptable. But acceptable does not mean safe. It means as low as reasonably achievable. In other words, as low as the industry claims it can afford to achieve. Radioactive wastes are produced by the fissioning of the uranium and by the neutron activation of corrosion products or rust in the reactor coolant system. I'd like to mention the first technical word I learned when I started my study of nuclear power. It was crud, the name given to the corrosion products in the primary cooling system. It was created as an acronym for Chalk River Unidentified Deposits, referring to the extremely radioactively hot and dangerous rust that was first found at the Chalk River plant in Canada following an accident. The corrosion products in a reactor become radioactive when they are bombarded by neutrons. They accumulate on the piping, fuel rods, valves, steam generator tubes, and even on the walls of the reactor vessel itself. Some of the activation products that slough off into the cooling water escape past the particulate filters and end up being released to the environment. The rust that builds up in the steam generators, that is, in the secondary cooling system, are not called crud. They're called the green grunge. These corrosion products, it's very hard to find humor in this field, you know. These corrosion products also clog up essential cooling equipment and give off highly penetrating gamma rays that place welders and other workers at great risk during the repair and replacement of leaking components. To give a sense of how much radiation is emitted, one repair of corroded components at Indian Point 1, about 25 miles from Times Square in New York, took 8 months and required 700 men in order to stay within the radiation exposure regulations. A similar repair effort in a conventional power plant would have taken about 2 weeks, not 8 months, using 25 men, not 700 men. In order to try to reduce the radiation fields in which workers must repair defective equipment and to make the reactor operate more efficiently, solvents are often used, including chelating agents that dissolve the highly radioactive crud. The chelating agents form multiple bonds, making them very persistent in nature. They are able to keep the dissolved radioactive rust in solution, increasing its mobility in the environment potentially for many decades and beyond. When wastes bonded to chelates are buried, they are able to migrate out of the trenches into the groundwater and the uncontrolled environment. Many years ago, I compared the burial of chelated waste from nuclear power plants to burying radioactive waste with roller skates on. Chelates are at times flushed through a plant's cooling systems while a plant is online or during shutdown for a refueling or maintenance in order to dislodge the corrosion products and other radioactive materials that have plated out onto the various surfaces. Unless the plant's liquid radioactive waste containing chelates are kept isolated from the rest of the waste, the dissolved waste can become a part of the waste stream that is released into the river, lake, or ocean. Since the chelates are non-biodegradable in nature, the crud bonded to the chelates remains dissolved and highly mobile. The buildup of crud at reactors nationwide and the resulting increase in radioactive waste will obviously increase within the older plants for which operating licenses have been extended to a 60-year duration instead of 40 years for which the plants were designed. When I initially began reading about nuclear power, I accepted the claim that the heated pressurized water in a typical reactor circulates in a, quote, closed loop, that is, from the reactor vessel into some 22,000 thin-walled steam generator tubes in order to generate steam to run the turbine generator, and then goes back into the reactor vessel. But I gradually learned that the closed loop is not completely closed. Proponents of the increased use of nuclear power like to say that no air pollutants are released from nuclear reactors. That just is not true. Radioactive wastes are released into the air and water as a part of the routine operation of every nuclear power plant.
That was Kay Dry, board member of NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You can find out more about her work on the website of NIRS. That's www.nirs.org. David Lockbaum began his career as nuclear engineer a few months after the Three Mile Island meltdown. For the next 17 years, he worked at nuclear power plants in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Kansas, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, and Connecticut. Now he is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where he monitors the performance of all U.S. nuclear power plants. Here is David Lockbaum.
The title of my talk this morning is called Nuclear Ghosts. I want to talk about the ghosts of nuclear past, the ghosts of nuclear present, and the ghosts of nuclear future. There's been some discussion already this morning about one of the ghosts of nuclear past, that being Davis-Besse. Davis-Besse was shut down between February of 2002 and March of 2004 to allow the minimum safety levels to be restored. Davis-Besse is well known for the leak that ate through the reactor vessel head and caused that football-sized hole. Less well known, but just as important, are the many other problems that were fixed during that two-year outage, any one of which should have kept the reactor down. It had that hole in the reactor head opened up, the backup systems were broken at Davis-Besse. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission knew about that because they informed the president with a letter they sent on Valentine's Day. I don't know if that was ironic or not. It wasn't President Bush, it wasn't President Clinton, it was President Carter that they notified of that problem back in 1979, and they then did nothing with it for several decades. In fact, Davis-Besse has now fixed that problem. All the other pressurized water reactors in the country have not fixed that backup system. To complicate that matter, the paint inside the reactor building was peeling and falling down in big sheets, which in case of an accident would have been carried by the water and plugged up the pumps that would have been needed to cool the reactor core and prevent a meltdown. The NRC inspectors knew the paint was falling because they were very carefully not to let them hit them in the head as they walked through the containment, but they did nothing about it. The emergency diesel generators that are provided at this facility in case the grid goes down, which the company that owns Davis-Besse caused the grid outage in August of 2003, Davis-Besse was shut down at the time, fortunately, because its diesel generators would not have worked. The NRC knew about that problem as well, but didn't fix it until the plant was shut down for other reasons. And the last example for this morning is that the safety pumps that would have been needed to protect the public in case of an accident at this plant were broken. These pumps were the only ones in the United States operated by a manufacturer in Canada. The manufacturer of the pumps had known that these pumps were broken, and they fixed them at all other nuclear facilities operated by the company that supplied the pumps to, France, Belgium, and other places. Those pumps were replaced and fixed by 1991. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission heard about that but did not require Davis-Besse to fix its broken pumps. I don't expect NRC inspectors to know about every problem that Davis-Besse had, but could they have found and fixed at least one of them over the many years that they had? If they can't fix obvious problems that other people are fixing, what confidence should anybody have that they'll find the next one? Don't take my word for it. In 1997, the General Accounting Office did a report on three troubled plants that the NRC had missed. The Salem nuclear plant in New Jersey was one of the three that the General Accounting Office looked at. The NRC required that plant to remain shut down until 43 safety problems were fixed. So the General Accounting Office did a timeline on each of those 43 items and showed that the NRC knew about 38 of those 43 items for years when the plant was operating. GAO asked the NRC, if these are problems that have to be fixed before the plant's restarted, why did you allow the plant to operate knowing that they were there? The NRC treated that as a rhetorical question and did not answer it. Multiple choice works better with this agency. The industry and the NRC point proudly to the fact that they haven't melted a reactor down since 1979. In those 26 years, they've had other problems. Davis-Bessie is the 45th time in that 26-year period that a United States reactor has been shut down for a year or longer to fix safety problems. 45 times in 26 years, you had to shut a reactor down for over a year to fix safety problems. What that tells me, the nuclear past, is that poor management by nuclear power plant owners, coupled with poor oversight by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, have resulted in the costs of nuclear power being higher than they should have been, and the safety levels of nuclear power being much lower than they should have been. Turning to the ghosts of nuclear present, in the last few years, citing this improving safety trend, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is granting 20-year extensions to operating licenses, is approving 20% power uprates at nuclear power plants, is approving broad reductions in the testing and inspection frequencies at aging nuclear power plants, has reduced the number of inspectors that it has at nuclear power plants, and has placed limits on its own personnel on how many questions they can ask of nuclear power plant owners. They said you can ask one set of questions. I had people in the industry call me up and say, this is great. We provide stupid responses, and they can't ask follow-up questions. This is great. All in the sake of saving time and schedule, not safety, schedule. It's only a matter of time left alone on this course before they'll start populating the list of nuclear disasters that we've already seen. Which brings me to the nuclear future. We've made a lot of discussion over recent years about a thing called the bathtub curve, which is called that because of its shape. It's a U-shaped thing that looks like a bathtub. It describes the chance of failure as a function of time for cars or power plants or light bulbs or anything.
Humans.
The left-hand part of the curve is the infant mortality phase of life for humans, or the break-in phase for products. Then you have the flat portion, which is the peak middle health years for people. And then you have the right-hand part of the curve, which is the wear-out zone for products or people. All of the nuclear power plants in the United States, those 103 or 104, depending on how you count them, are entering, if not already in, the wear-out zone of that curve, where the failure rate increases with time. If you look at the infant mortality phase, the accidents we've had, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Browns Ferry, Fermi, all have occurred in the first year or two of that plant's lifetime. That's the infant mortality phase, where the chance of risk was very high and those reactors didn't get out of that high-risk area. We're now heading to the wear-out zone. Unless we change how we're doing business, we'll start putting names on that part of the curve, as we've already named the wear-in phase or the break-in phase of the curve. And there are plenty of examples, warning signs, to point to Davis-Bessie being just one sign of aging. Just since the millennium, the year 2000, Indian Point has had an aging problem that caused an emergency. The Summer plant in South Carolina had 900 pounds of boric acid leak out on the floor. It was less well-known than Davis-Bessie. The Callaway plant in Missouri has had problems with aging. The Oconee plant in South Carolina, Davis-Bessie's had a number of problems. San Onofre plant in California, part of the energy crisis in California was caused by a 25-year-old electrical breaker at San Onofre failing because it was scheduled for inspection, but to save money, they pushed it out into the next refueling outage, which is 1 year too many. It failed along the way, caused that plant to be out of service for several months. Those are pressurized water problems. On the other side of the house, the boiling water reactors, just since the year 2000, Quad Cities has broken its steam dryer twice due to the power upgrade they did. They had warning signs that that was coming. A vibration monitor on a steam line that was installed to monitor vibrations shook off and fell on the floor. They reacted to that by putting it back on the pipe and securing it more soundly, rather than seeing that there was a sign that the pipe was vibrating way, way too much. So when you miss the warning signs, you pay a heavy price. Nine Mile Point has had a number of problems with its core shroud. Limerick has twice has had problems with its backup safety systems. And Oyster Creek has a whole list of problems that would take a lot of time to go over, even just to highlight. But the bottom line, the ghosts of nuclear future, is that if the chronically bad management that this industry has faced and the chronically ineffective oversight provided by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are not remedied soon, then the future of nuclear power in the United States will merely be a replay of its troubled past. And that it was dumb to do that first. It would be really stupid to experience that a second time.
That was David Lockbaum, nuclear safety engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He is the author of two books, Nuclear Waste Disposal Crisis and Everything You Know Is Wrong, Fission Stories, Nuclear Power Secrets. That's a compilation of reports of nuclear accidents since 1968. Come back for the last part in this four-part series entitled Nuclear Power for a Police State or A Police State for Nuclear Power. You heard the third part in a mini-series on the urgent question, are nuclear power plants coming back to the USA? Thanks to the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, Helen Caldicott's organization, for making the recordings available. Visit their website at www.nuclearpolicy.org. That's nuclearpolicy.org. You can find links to all organizations mentioned in this program on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's TUCRadio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.